Hi, this is The Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. It's a special, very special episode of The Reason Podcast. We are at FECON in Atlanta, the Foundation for Economic Education, a large student group. About 700 people are here, and FEE is the oldest of the continuing free market think tanks, do tanks groups. They're putting on a big show here in Atlanta, and I'm at the Reason booth, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
You are one of our young stars on the journalism side.
Not so young anymore.
Yeah, well,
but
trust me, age is relative. You're young.
Robbie and I are like we need some new young blood to We're not exactly, but yes, yes.
So, let's just say you haven't worked here that long.
Yes, okay. Yes.
So in our fantastic most recent issue, the Burn After Reading issue, which has a bunch of things that are legal, barely legal, semi-legal, illegal in certain places, things like making pot brownies, things like what else is in there?
Cannabis-infused cocktails, how to get out of handcuffs,
I think. Brownies, making pot brownies.
Yeah.
How to surveil people without breaking the law, I guess. But you contributed a section on cryptography, kind of everyday cryptography. What is your article about, and why were you moved to write about that?
It's sort of like a, personal or consumer encryption 101 piece. And I was motivated to write about it because I was finding stuff out for myself, actually, like as a, not just in response to Facebook, but actually before that, more in response to some stuff with Google and just various things that now that I sort of write about stuff that's a little bit sensitive sometimes, I was like, I don't actually want to be doing all of this on Google Docs and doing this and things like that. So I started researching, like the best encrypted emails, the best, searches that didn't track or record your search history, just all on the best, encrypted chat messages and things like that. And then this issue was coming up. So I was talking about what I found with Stephanie Slade and Catherine Mangaward in the Reason DC kitchen, and they were like, you should write about this for the Burn After Reading issue.
So have you shifted your daily practice? Because a lot of times, one of the reasons we leave a lot of information out in the open is just because you learn one way and then you ever change. How has this changed your email practice? How has it changed? Do you actually not use Google Docs, or do you somehow encrypt them? What have you done differently?
It's hard switching from Google, because everything I do is Google, and I'm so used to it for so many things. But I think more, I do have a Proton Mail address, which is an encrypted, and I think probably the best one as far as I can tell, email service. And so I do use that now, in addition to my Gmail account, both I check, both every day, but, I don't have a lot of people emailing me there, so it's kind of hard to remember to do it. And also, it's more, I think, just kind of, I know now when I need to do certain things, like how I've thought twice about doing it this way, and I know the services I can use if I'm doing sensitive stuff. And I actually haven't been in the past, few weeks or anything, so I haven't needed to. But
So when you go missing, not even bother looking for you because you'll have covered your tracks.
Exactly. Yeah.
I can remember when Gmail came out, which I guess was like 2004, 2003,
So 2004, 2005. I was just out of college then, and I got,
But in the crypto or in the computer movement, it was seen bizarrely. First off, it's kind of fascinating how quickly these things change. When email started coming out, and most people had email through work. I mean, there were AOLs and CompuServes and Earthlinks. But everybody agreed that you had no expectation to privacy on your email because it was owned by your company or whoever owned the server where it resided or passed through. And that was the, the kind of standing supposition. And so like a lot, if you went to email seminars or something, they'd say like, don't send sensitive stuff there because it is a public document. It is a public record. And it, and your admin, your work admin has access to all of this stuff. And then when Gmail came out, and Gmail was predicated, it was a free searchable email system for anybody who wanted it, but they were using robots, or basically they were doing word searches to see what was in the email you were sending to deliver ads around the frame of the Gmail. to pay for the service. And one of the things that was amazing, from one year to the next, people at the Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference, one of the main things for like hackers, went apeshit. They were like, how dare corporate Google invade our privacy while giving us something for free? And I was just like, God, that is so bizarre, you know, like, and nobody was, that would, very few people were like, you know, oh, we're talking the complete opposite way we were just a year ago.
I thought the story was going to go completely differently, Nick. I thought you were going to say, and people really like embrace them as like good guys and stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what I remember, but I guess I didn't hang out with crazy hackers.
Yeah. And I don't know when Google, you know, came up with Don't Be Evil, and it might have been, you know, maybe it was partly in response to that type of stuff, but it's interesting. And I know with things like telephone calls, at first, telephone calls were seen as public conversations, you know, and there were early court decisions saying, like, well, you're on a telephone, you have no expectation of privacy. And then a couple of years later, you know, law enforcement had to get a warrant to listen in, to tap your phone and stuff like that. So the issues of privacy and how we relate to it are, I think, are always fascinating because they seem to shift so much.
Yeah. Also, the issues are, I guess, you know, kind of the public perception of these companies that are doing the same thing, but I guess the different ways, I don't know, like one of the things actually I did touch on in this article too, is how, you know, in the early internet days, there was this sort of, you know, anarchist like ethos that was happening where people were like, you know, information wants to be free and this is going to decentralize things and it's going to make everything better and stuff. And then, you know, that kind of didn't pan out and we had, you know, AOL owning everything, whatever. And then when you had the social media starting then, like, it, you know, around that time, and I think that they're actually, the companies that we now think of as dominating things like Facebook and YouTube and whatever, but I mean, they were all about this, that same sort of thing. They had this spirit, like, this is actually going to make, you know, everybody a creator. This is going to get rid of gatekeepers. And so now I thought it was interesting that in a lot of these encrypted email services and chat apps and things have manifestos and have like a really strong like privacy ethos and anarchist ethos that like sounds a lot like some of these past ones.
Well, that was Skype, which is now owned by Microsoft, was started. If you read the manifesto, the guys who started Skype, who were, I believe, Swedish, and then they moved to Estonia or Latvia. They were going to revolutionize the world by free, you know, free peer-to-peer phone calls and whatnot. And now it's part of Microsoft.
Yeah.
And it's a great service. You know, it's the rapidity with which, you know, the utopian dreams and services get reincorporated into everyday life.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's either deeply depressing or it's kind of exciting, you know. I don't know. Do you also write a lot about sex work, which is a place where I assume there's a lot of coding going on there. Like when people, you know, this is one of the fun things when a Madam's Black Book gets out into the public, there's always questions of like, who is client 13 or whatever. And this is an industry, because it's illegal, it deals in cryptography or code.
Yeah.
What's the latest in the kind of war against sex work?
Well, especially because recently FOSTA, or it was a package of bills called SESTA and FOSTA rolled into one, passed, and it, you know, makes facilitating prostitution via a digital medium a federal crime. And so that has a lot of people freaking out, and you know that also them going after Backpage and shutting down Backpage, the classified.
Explain what Backpage was.
The classified, it's a classified advertising site, much like Craigslist, with all sorts of different categories. But one of its most well known and sort of scapegoated was its adult section, which had, you know, things for strippers and you know, fetish stuff, and also for a lot of escorts and, you know, very thinly veiled prostitution ads. And the federal prosecutors just seized it and took it down and charged, and they've arrested its owners and CEO and things. So that actually didn't have anything to do with FOSTA passing. It was independent of that, which sort of proved what people had been saying, that we didn't need FOSTA, which is a like deeply flawed bill that changes a sort of fundamental precept of the internet that has nothing to do with sex at all. But come back to that one second.
Sure.
But like, you know, people were saying, we don't need this very flawed bill because you can go after people like Backpage. If Backpage is doing something wrong, which, you know, that's an if, but if they are, you can go after them anyways. And the you know, the DOJ is showing that they could do that. But right before they did that, FOSTA passed. And so this atmosphere has created a lot of fear just in general amongst, all sorts of people in the sex work community. So they've been, you know, there's a lot of new platforms. There's one called Crocker. There's, I forget some of the others, but there's been a lot of new platforms that are like Twitter almost, or Twitter based, like interface, and also a more Craigslisty or Blackpage interface that are based either on foreign servers and things like that. You see a lot of sex workers just sort of giving tutorials, or like legal people giving tutorials for sex workers about how to use encrypted email, how to switch to chat apps, and for dealing with clients and things like that, and just sort of knowing how to.
I am all for encrypted email if it means I don't actually have to read email anymore. That's my sense of it. I back in the day, I used PGP, which was one of the first broad-based, cheap, free. And now it was seen as unhackable, but it can actually be broken now. But that was something the government freaked out under the Clintons because PGP was, at that point, they were treating encryption programs as munitions. They were trying to classify them under export under laws that would mean you needed export licenses from the government, clearance to ship stuff, because they were like, the terrorists are going to get this, foreign governments are going to get this, and that's the end of it. And, which, again, just all of this stuff is, we're in a long loop of, something from the 1990s on. Good. Talk about Section 230 and how, because this is something I think a lot of people see mentions of it. They may not fully understand what role that's playing in the kind of free speech freakout over these sex work laws.
Yeah, so Section 230 is it's Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is a 90s law that, it did a lot of things, but Section 230 specifically says that that a digital content platform should not be treated as the speaker of speech that is created by users. So, at that time it was sort of limited circumstances, and now it applies to so much, but, it's pretty much saying that if someone comments on Reason's comment section or posts a tweet
Posts
to Facebook.
I'm just going out on a limb here. Somebody comments at Reason that they think a particular federal judge who made a really bad ruling in a particularly stupid case should be fed into a wood chipper.
Right. Who would do that? But
I know nobody, but like they did in Fargo, that Reason, as the publisher of that comment, it's published on our website, but it is not, we're not responsible for it.
Right. And so it applies to, social media, it applies to, news platforms and, comment sections, it applies to pretty much, everything because of the way that the internet has sort of developed over the past decade and a half now. It's very important to that because it also, there's a Good Samaritan clause in it too, which says, you can do some filtering of content and that doesn't make you the
fully
speaker.
Because you get rid of some comments, it doesn't mean you're responsible for whatever you leave or anything.
Right.
And I just as a little bit of backstory, the Communications Decency Act in the 90s, and this was an early win for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Mike Godwin was their chief counsel. He was now a Reason contributing editor, the guy who came up with Godwin's Law. But that Communications Decency Act overall was terrible and was fought heavily and ended up most of it getting struck down in the Supreme Court because it would have effectively treated the internet like a broadcast network, and it would have put it under the control of either the FCC or some other similar agency for content regulation. So that was great. Section 230 is like the thing really that allowed the internet to become the internet in a lot of ways.
Definitely. And it's
and the argument here is that with the FOSTA-SESTA ruling that's nibbling away at that.
Yeah. So, actually, Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, Democratic senator, he's, co-authored Section 230. And he was one of two senators along with Rand Paul who voted against it because it carves out an exception for prostitution ads. So already, Section 230 doesn't apply to federal law. So federal laws, if you violate federal law, they can still go after you. But it means that you can't be, subject to civil suits and you can't be subject to state prosecutions for this content. And so, they carved out a big exception for it. And because, people are worried that it's going to create this effect where now that if they know if you can carve out an exception for this, then they're going to start carving out exceptions for other things, maybe for gun-related things, maybe for, hate speech-related things or whatever. But now that we've sort of carved it out, that it's going to keep going. It's also just having effects, though, regardless. Even if it's found, even if FOSTA ends up being found unconstitutional and being struck down, it's already, people are so worried, websites are so worried that anything related to sex could get them in trouble in violation of this law, that they are just, banning all sorts of stuff. There was a Wall Street Journal article recently about how
I thought you said they're banning all sorts of sodomy.
No, sorry. They're banning all sorts of stuff, and then I think I pivoted to the it's affecting even dating sites. It's affecting people doing sex education content. It's affecting sex workers who are doing sex worker rights organizing. I mean, sites just aren't letting this content go up now, or are banning communities around it because they're just worried that anything like that could be seen as facilitating prostitution, or just by creating an open platform for Craigslist took down its personal section, which is, just for dating. It's not for supposedly, paid dating, but because sometimes it was a place where people then would post since they didn't have an adult section, they just took it down entirely because that might make them liable.
Well,
they worried.
You mentioned, the moment where things seem to be utopian and expanding, and then at times they consolidate and centralize. And, we're, a couple months away or past the Facebook hearings, which they were interesting for all sorts of reasons, including the fact that Mark Zuckerberg, when asked should Facebook be regulated, he said yes, and I look forward to helping you with that regulation. There definitely seems to be a sense that whatever the web or the internet was, that era is coming to a close. And
yeah.
You see, all sorts
definitely.
Of different ways where, and that's...
Because, also been, for all sorts of reasons related to federal regulations and things, there have been, crackdowns on speech-related content, on gun-related content, on, all sorts of things lately on YouTube, on, being demonetizing certain creators, and just, I think on video game platforms you're seeing changes, and it also has to do, with the European privacy rule changes. But
right, yeah.
Yeah, in general, it's just...
It's weird, and then I guess, how much of that, a lot of this ultimately, it starts at the top and then is forced on things, like through laws. But then there's the companies themselves. Facebook itself tightened up certain types of rules. Twitter seems to have gotten more aggressive in patrolling certain things, certainly YouTube. How much do you think all of this is tied to an increasing worry in the culture, using air quotes? But people, is it your sense that people are less interested in free speech, or at least the edges of free speech, than they were maybe 10 or 15 years ago?
No, I don't think so overall. I just think that the way that our communication platforms have risen up in the past 10 years, and the incentives of how information spreads on, say, platforms like Twitter, creates the appearance that there's a much larger anti-free speech contingent in than there actually is. Because I think when you talk to people, any sorts of people, everywhere, in all sorts of political circles, just in the real world, or when you talk, there's so many people who aren't, but there's this very loud sort of, what people sometimes call the social justice warriors or whatever you want to call them. There's this very loud group that, they create bots. That's what's kind of the funny thing. So the Russian bots that everyone's talking about, the first time I encountered people in mass using bots was in part of a transgender movement versus radical feminist movement fight, where both sides had created all these Twitter bots that were yelling at each other to make it appear that there was more people on their side.
So these are like Potemkin armies battling one another. I want to get to that conversation, because that's the that's the TERF battle, the TERF battle. Before we go there, though, tell me a little bit about sex work. Here's my question about sex work, and as a good libertarian, I think people should be allowed to do whatever they want, as long as they're not, openly harming each other, or, in a way that is, they don't like, I guess. I don't know how far I want to take all of that. Is there any evidence, though? I think one of the tough questions that sometimes gets asked about sex work is, what are the effects on both the, the buyer and the seller over time? And are there... first off, are there predictable effects that are negative for either side? As a first question, and then based on that, there may be a question about, is it, then does it become a profession or a practice that we would disallow as a society? But seems to be a lot of, the arguments seem to be less now about the morality of it, and it's more of kind of the psychological impact.
Yeah, although I think that there's some used net recover, the old morality and media now that fought, porn and rap music in the 80s and 90s now rebranded as the National Center Against Sexual Exploitation, and they framed their arguments. That was sort of a deliberate choice of some of those movements.
Right.
But no.
And certainly the idea that, this is all trafficking, because it couldn't be that, people were participating in this as sex workers voluntarily.
Right.
They have to be drugged and beaten
and
scared
into it. And that's
been
something that they've pretty much, very much succeeded in normalizing as an idea in like American thought and media over the past two decades. But, I mean, no, there are not any good studies showing effects for many reasons, because they're, you know, an underground population or whatever. Any studies that do sort of exist are generally with populations that say, like, repeat offenders that are in, you know, prison, or people who are visiting a rape trauma center and were also sex workers. So they come out with very skewed results that make it sound like, but they're only going from a very, you know. I think that just sort of anecdotally and reading, you know, all the stuff out there. I mean, now more than ever, you can talk to sex workers yourself and hear them speak for themselves because of social media. I mean, that's one of the amazing things that's changed over the past 10 years. But I think that the harms that are unique to sex work right now are all harms that are related to the black market aspect of it rather than the industry itself. Like, much like with the criminalization of drugs, you know, like the things that are dangerous are, you know, not being able to go to the police if something bad happens, not being able to work in groups because that can be seen as a brothel and then, you know, more chances of sex trafficking charges, like not being able to do all these things, not being able now to use the internet where they can screen clients and, you know, all that stuff. So it's directly.
Is pimping a problem? You know, because I can see, you know, I mean, we have the classic image of the pimp who beats his whores into submission and keeps them in semi-slavery. But then it's also like the pimp, the pimp as a manager, you could also see the pimp in an open market as being really helpful.
Yeah, well, that's why the word pimp is really unuseful, actually. Because, yeah, I mean, right now, people who are just, who are doing any sort of, you know, helping to schedule or being a bodyguard or whatever, like services that, you know, if you talk to any sex workers, like Maggie McNeil, who's written for us a lot, talks about all this all the time, about services that are very useful and that independent sex workers want. They can't pay for, or if they do, those people risk being classified as pimps just for providing these sort of things. I mean, yes, obviously there are also violent, you know, pimps of the stereotypical sort out there. Sure, just like there's, you know, all sorts of bad crime out there. But again, like one of the things that has helped stop that has been the advent of sites like Backpage and all sorts of, you know, social media, because it's allowed people for the first time to have this really easy platform for, you know, reaching out to clients directly, finding clients directly, all that sort of stuff. And so you saw a lot more people go independent. And now, I mean, that's been one of the biggest complaints from sex workers on the internet since FOSTA has passed and in the lead up to it, is that like now people are going to have to either go back out onto the streets, or they're going to have to, a lot of them have been turning to pimps. One of them called it the Pimp Full Employment Act, because they said that three people had reached out to her already, like three old pimps, and that she had left, you know, them because she'd been able to work for herself using Backpage.
Right.
And that now they're like, haha, you have to come to us because you can't find clients otherwise if you don't have these sort of direct platforms. And so,
and it does seem like, you know, for any kind of negotiation among relative strangers, I mean, this is what's incredible about things like Airbnb and Lyft and Uber, is that they come up with that, you know, they get around the lack of reputational knowledge by creating safeguards. I mean, when you think about it, taxi cabs obviously do this in the sense for the driver, you know, the driver has a license or something, but they are just picking up random strangers.
Right.
And that's why a lot of cab drivers, you know, carry guns with them, because they have no idea who they're picking up. You know, but when you think of Uber or Airbnb or these services where the users, everybody's a known quantity, and it releases a lot of tension and worry, I think.
Yeah,
and that would fit perfectly well with prostitution.
Yeah, I mean, just one more thing, like this case I wrote about in Seattle a couple of years ago involving the review board, which was exactly sort of that sort of thing. It was a thing that had developed over like 15 years, and sex workers and customers created profiles there, and it was granted all semi sort of anonymous, you know, or pseudonymous, but like people knew each other's, you know, in the community, and like they would all, you know, you could go and see everyone's history and stuff. So it was sort of useful from that.
Well, let's talk about the TERFs. What's going on there? Because this, again, is, social media is everywhere under attack, sometimes for good reason, sometimes not. I mean, it does have a lot of negative aspects to it, but it's also kind of fun, and it definitely has given voice to people who otherwise were voiceless. What's the problem between transgender people and so-called TERFs?
Well, you tweeted a thread recently. So do you want to explain that? And then I have
not so much. You're the guest, but no, it's
okay. So this is just funny, because it's, I was reading that, and 5 years ago I experienced my first full-blown Twitter storm, where I was the subject of the hate at the center of the Twitter storm. And it was because I had interviewed a woman who is a feminist. She considers herself a radical feminist, which some people call them trans-exclusionary radical feminist, which shortens to TERF. And she was talking about, there was this big fight raging on Twitter between the trans community and the rad femme community about, you know, whether or not it was transphobic and hateful for lesbians not to want to date trans women, because and this is an argument. So anyways, I thought that was fascinating, and I was like, I interviewed this one woman on the trans side, and I interviewed one woman on the rad femme side, and I posted about it, but everyone thought it was horrible that I even let this woman on the rad femme side even be interviewed, and mm-hmm. So I became like the subject of some hate for a little bit. But so I say all that just because that was a controversy that was happening in 2013, and it's funny that it just seems to flare up again on the internet every so often, and it's flaring up again, I guess, this week or last week, in conjunction with Pride.
Well, so, and I guess part of it is that a lot of times the people who either are looking in at groups or alliances, like, you know, gay, lesbian, bi, trans, queer, there's, you know, it, we assume that there's a commonality there, and there is, I mean, in terms of they're all people who are excluded because of alternative sexualities, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily get along. And I remember,
well, and also the trans thing isn't, though, necessarily alternative sexualities, right? It kind of doesn't fit, because it's more
identity.
About your identity, but it's more about your gen, like, not who you're attracted to, but who you feel like,
right?
Because it doesn't, you know, a lot of times trans people don't necessarily, you know, have a attraction to one or the other. So it's actually, it is sort of an odd one out. I was about to say the odd man out, and I was like, that's probably just a hate crime in some context in this conversation. But
Do you, having said all of that, it does seem that the level of acceptance of virtually any kind of identity position seems very strong, much stronger now than 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
And then so in that sense, it becomes interesting when you see things like this flare up. And what is the argument that a radical feminist would make against dating a transsexual? And that would be a male to female transgender.
Yeah.
Person.
So, you know, a trans woman would be someone who is born as a male and then, you know, transition to being female, which doesn't necessarily mean that they are, you know, assigned male at birth is, I guess, the terminology. But doesn't necessarily mean that they have transitioned physically or that they've done any sort of surgery or hormones. I mean, they might or they might not have. So,
By the way, bringing in the old perspective, when I was growing up, the big celebrity transgender person was Renee Richards, who had been a dentist named Richard Rankin. And then transitioned to being a woman, had surgery. Like, surgery was very important, and she wanted to play in the women's professional tennis tour. And it became, like, a big thing because transition, and then is she really a man? And then she'll, you know, kick ass because men are so much better at tennis, blah, blah, blah. In the back of that was the Billie Jean King, Bobby Riggs tennis tournament, you know. But what I'm getting at is that up until sometime, I don't know, in the past 20 years or so, it seemed to me that being trans meant a commitment to the surgery, to gender reassignment surgery, and that has faded, which is also kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and it's interesting, just it's part of a general shift. Like, obviously there are lots of people who did, you know, the things that people, but didn't get the surgery, and they just didn't call themselves trans. Yeah. But the transgender has, broadened to include them. But also, it's sort of, you know, there's a lot of people who maybe just would have been, you know, called like butch lesbians or sort of, you know, like different sorts of subcultures of lesbianism and the gay community that now, in like younger people would just, now they say that they're non-binary or that they're whatever, but it's, or they might consider themselves trans, but they don't consider themselves like a butch lesbian or something, which is weird. I feel like I've been, like, I'm kind of in between the two, like, ages where, like, one or the other was dominant, so it's been sort of weird to watch that.
What, there's no question that as much, society has kind of, I think, reached a certain comfort level with people being gay or lesbian. trans, you know, which is a very small percentage. I mean, I think the last number I saw for the number of people who are trans is something like 0.3% of the population. And these numbers are all kind of sketchy because we're, you know, it's
hard
to get.
Yeah, I was going to say something like 1%.
But in any case, it's like a very small percentage of people. But you saw this when Caitlyn Jenner came out and, you know, particularly on the right. But then occasionally, you know, radical feminists attacking trans people. As a concept, what do you think it is about the trans identity that flips people's shit?
Well, if you think about how, like, the gay community, you know, sort of the path to where we are now with sexuality and homosexuality, like, it was a lot about people are very threatened by the idea of men and women not being separate and, like, gender roles not existing as they, you know, people think that they've existed forever or whatever. And so, you know, that was a sort of big fear. I think that gay people were just going to, like, you know, meld everything all together. But then when there was, I mean, and obviously I'm really oversimplifying, but when, you know, when it sort of became a thing like, look, like, two men might just want to get married and have a kid and be very conservative, or two women, you know, and they should, like, you know, that we could be gay, but also just, like, a very normal conservative, almost like there's a male and a female within, like, right. You know, a masculine and a feminine even, yeah, within the relationships. And I think that people got comfortable with that. It was like, okay, we got
because
that.
It's not really a threat to our basic divisions,
right. Yeah.
in life or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it was, but now people have reconceptualized it enough. Right. Even almost the most, you know, conservatives
have reconceptualized
it. And
this is what people who call themselves queer often, and I guess like Larry Kramer and a couple of other older AIDS activists, their whole thing is like, we're gay to avoid kind of falling into that bourgeois lifestyle of, you know, living in a white picket fence and having dogs and kids and cars.
Yeah.
So that's always been around, but it does seem like mainstream society has more or less gotten comfortable with,
right,
the idea of gays who act like heteros, right?
Right. Like now there are gay subcultures that are like,
yeah,
but not, yeah, as a, that are like that. But yeah, anyway, but I think that, you know, the trans thing now strikes at that same sort of fear in a different way that people haven't been able to, you know, because if you can just, now it's not just about like, oh, people, you know, but it's about them becoming the different categories or just like blurring the lines entirely. And I think that freaks people out because you said like this fundamental sort of,
what is the effect on politics, do you think? I mean, we work at Reason, which, you know, talks about politics, culture, and ideas. And you know, I think part of our starting point is the idea that culture and ideas really dominate and then they show up in politics. What do you think the effect of these kinds of challenges to traditional gender roles or gender identities ends up having on politics? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? How does it get used in the political arena?
No, yeah, it's horrible, I think, on both sides. I feel like the Democrats, you know, I was going to say tokenize, I don't know exactly, but, you know, hold trans people up as, or trans issues up as a thing to try and, you know, be like, they're not very sincere in their commitment a lot of the times, but they will use them as a sort of issue to be like, yeah, we want like young progressives to be on board. And then, you know, on the right, obviously, I feel like it's taken the place where now, yeah, demonizing gays and demonizing gay marriage has like not, doesn't really sell very well with a lot of crowds anymore. So they can't do that, but they need something that fills that void. So it fills that particular void for conservatives.
Yeah.
I feel like that's how it seeps into.
So
I mean, it's just taken over, yeah, the gay
what
culture
is
divide.
What is the...
Which is funny because it's so small. It's so much, yeah, smaller, but it's like everyone needed something to fill that.
Yeah. So what is... How should libertarians deal with that in a, I don't know, in a kind of policy context? Because you don't want to just ignore people, right? And
right,
you know, if somebody's saying, look, my, you know, basic identity is that I'm a trans person, like, you don't want to be like, oh... I mean, part of me wants to say, that's great. That's why you should be against the minimum wage and you should be for school choice. But that seems like an inadequate human response to somebody telling me something that's really important to them.
I mean, I think, yeah, where libertarians, I mean, I think we've talked about this before. We're sort of on the same page, like where, you know, definitely fully on board with people being able to, you know, be kind of whoever they want to be. So if that is, you know, living as not the gender or they were born, whatever, you know, using whatever pronouns, whatever, like it's sometimes we're trying to step in and make the state, you know, makes these sorts of things compulsory that does, you know, run libertarians into trouble, I think, with the trans rights movement. But one particular area that I think we should be, like, libertarians should be focusing on more, and that's a really good area of alignment, is just sort of with sex and gender designations on government documents. Mm-hmm. And there's been, you know, pushes in various places across the United States and in Canada and elsewhere to have, you know, not have either to have a gender neutral designation, like you can choose male or female or X or non-binary or non whatever, or just non-specified. Which is a good step, I think, definitely.
Yeah.
One thing, I read this book by Beyond Trans by Heath Fogg Davis, and it's a really amazing book about just how maybe we should just get rid of the gender categories on so many government IDs and so many IDs
what
in general.
What is the benefit of that? Because I always thought that, you know, and I know that the airlines want you to be male or female so that they can, you know, you can't change your ticket as
right.
easily and stuff like that. But what's the argument for getting rid of gender designation on an ID when it might be helpful to?
Well, because, I mean, a lot of times when you're talking about an ID, there's going to be a picture on there, there's going to be a height and a weight
yeah.
and a hair color. So there's going to be all these things that identify you. When it comes to the gender, a lot of times it trips up people who are trans, obviously, or who identify as non-binary and don't fit, you know, these sort of
right.
gender norms. But it also just trips up anybody who's gender non-conforming, which turns to be, like, elderly people
yeah.
or just people who, like, you know, women who look very masculine, men who look very feminine.
We both spend time in Ohio, and Ohio is, like, it's not the David Bowie, Twiggy, non-gender.
Yeah, it's more like Pat.
It's like it's Pat.
Yeah.
It's the Campbell Soup Kids. You walk down the street and men and women in Columbus, Ohio, a lot of it, you know, the androgyny there is like they're chubby, they're overweight, they're wearing khakis,
yeah.
a blue button-down shirt, and they have a soup ball haircut. I don't know what they are.
Well, so exactly. And, you know, from a people's welfare standpoint, it's a big hassle for many people who fall
sure.
into these categories and a constant, you know, embarrassment to have to prove their gender. I mean,
right.
this book goes through some people who, no matter what they did, if they had the you know, the sex that they were born as their sex, they would get harassed because they were now dressing,
right.
living as a woman and looked and, you know, had clothes on like a woman. And so, but if they put woman on there, then they would be like, well, you know, they would, no matter what they put, they would
yeah.
still be not. And so that happens to a lot of people. And so, I mean, that's a concern. Also, I think from a libertarian standpoint, there's just like, you know, fuck you, the government doesn't need to know my gender or
yeah.
my sex kind of thing. I mean, like, you know, on every ID, like the city government doesn't need it on your driver's license. I'm not saying like abolish it on everything, although maybe. But, you know, there's a lot
well,
of more
and
places where we could get rid of it.
Yeah, if we're going to biometric data being put onto your ID, that's
right,
much
exactly.
more important, like at the cellular level. Like if you know me at the cellular level,
right.
you don't need to know what my junk
right.
looks like. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, you're making a pretty strong case there.
Washington, D.C. is actually, I think, the first city that lets you have a non-specified. You can choose male, female, or
And do you have one of these yet?
Yeah, so I had to get a new license because my license expired last week, and I waited right till the last time. But I went there, and I checked the, you know, non-specified box, and then they marked me as female anyways.
Really?
And I didn't notice it till I got home, and I got my, like, paper temporary ID.
Are you
going
to get
what?
That fixed?
So I tweeted about it, and... The DC DMV like wrote me on Twitter right away and was like, send us a DM and tell us your driver's license number and we'll take care of that right away and we'll send you a new one and everything. So they're gonna fix it.
So do you get, you just have no gender specified? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what it says. I think it's like NS or something, like not
that's
specified
gonna,
or something.
I know that somehow, somewhere, probably not now, but down the road, that's gonna become like, I can't operate on, you know, on this person. We don't know their gender. You know,
or it's going to get me like sent to the camps or something. But
yeah, that's
yeah.
true. Or yeah, maybe you'll be running the camps.
But it was, yeah, one last thing, though. This is kind of funny. You know, at the DMV, it was obviously like the whole thing. Like I had my cable bill wrong, so then I had to find another copy. But I sent it to them they wanted it in a PDF, not a screenshot. And so I like pasted it in the body of an email, and that wasn't good. We had to print it out like 6 times because they were very specific about how. Finally, I just like cropped the screenshot and gave it to them. And finally, that worked, right? So, but it was this whole thing. And then later, when I just like tweet something, the DC DMV is like, DM me, and we just
yeah.
like talked about it on DM, and that was that. And I'm just like,
I was
going to
say,
funny.
This is why we shouldn't have driver's licenses. You
yeah,
know, that's a whole
oh,
other
yeah,
podcast.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, are you a safer driver because you have a driver's license? You know.
So. Oh gosh, yeah, we'll save that for another time.
Well, we will leave it there. This is the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie, and I've been talking with Elizabeth Nolan Brown, a writer, reporter, researcher for Reason. We've covered a lot of ground, including about how to encrypt your email, about turf wars between radical feminists and trans rights activists, about DC's new genderless options for official ID and much more. Elizabeth, thanks for talking.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.